Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelley.
May 19, 2022, allegedly according to that thing we call a calendar. And this indeed is the show you were looking for. Although my mic is just a touch hot, it is Thursday. So we're going to get into some stuff here. And in the second hour, I'll be talking to at least Joseph L. Flatley from the Failed State Update. So we'll get the Failed State Update in the second hour of the O'Shelley Effect on this particular Thursday. So... Just finished up with the Jack Blood show. I gotta tell you, I found a lot of laughs there. So if you're listening to my show further on down the stream via your fondle slab of choice, your applicable application, your podcatcher du jour, I would also suggest you pick up that show because I was entertained, especially in the second hour. but maybe you guys will disagree with me. Anyway. Like I said, I got one guest in the second hour, but in the first, what am I going to do? I'm going to cover some news. Why not? And get at a couple of things that are not being discussed elsewhere. I really liked that Jack brought on the guy from United. What is the name of that organization? Good Lord. Let's just look at it really quickly. ColorUsUnited.org to talk about the Asian shooting, because as I said... previously on my show, there's the headline nobody is really interested in, because yawn, Asian on Asian crime for one reason or another. But I'm going to get into some other stuff, and frankly today what I want to focus on is, believe it or not, the Associated Press, because the incredible diversity of what it is they're covering is also keeping me entertained. What are we supposed to be talking about on shows like this? Well, a lot of people are going to overanalyze the various, what are they called? Primaries, right? In the key swing states, et cetera, et cetera. Who's going to get in there? Dr. Oz versus the guy with the heart attack, the stroke, everything else that's going on. Because why did I say heart attack first? Because it's reported that he had a stroke, Chuck. Yeah, I know that, but... he had a stroke, and then now he's having a pacemaker put in, according to reports. So I don't know what that means. Is this guy going to survive? Is there a reason why this guy might not survive? I guess we'll have to keep our eye on it. Meanwhile, one reality TV star supports another reality TV star. Donald Jeffries earlier this week couldn't understand why the Trump-supporting lady of color there is not getting support in Pennsylvania. It's because it doesn't make any sense in Pennsylvania, Don. I know, he's like, you know, QAnon light a bit, but what am I going to do with the guy? You know, very, very much like I don't have control over my hosts and what it is they do. Who knows? I mean, if they get bad enough, I could just disassociate. You know, I could cancel somebody. I know, that doesn't usually happen on here. It only happened once, actually, where somebody just went through so much pointlessness I had to. And most of it was off air, so... it is what it is. By the way, anybody wondering why Aaron Franz hasn't been around on the network, it is because he's in the midst of setting up Landers. And there's a key phrase for anybody who's a fan of The Age of Transitions or Uncle the Podcast. But we should hear from him shortly after a couple of things are organized and well-oiled and ready to roll. I think he's doing some live streams on his video channels, etc. So anyway... let's get to the news that is, right? The week that is, or the week that was, or maybe a little bit of both. And I'm going to focus, like I said, on the Associated Press, but there are other stories to cover. One of them of interest is, again, you know, stuff being mentioned that I brought up on this show, and now, you know, new stories being written about it once again, new information being given, etc. It is fascinating. I take a look at ancientorigins.net, which is ancient-origins.net, and I'll give you all the links to this in the podcast notes. What is the headline over there? And maybe I don't need to read it to the article, but Superfather, okay, which is funny because there's also a Netflix series right now about some fertility doctor impregnating, like, I don't know, hundreds of women with his own seed. Anyways, this is not about that. Superfather, although it's got a similar name to that show. one in 200 men are descendants of Genghis Khan. Okay? So I will read from the top of the article just really quickly. Let's see. Mongol Emperor Genghis Khan, okay, 1162 to 1227 AD, was not just an infamously ruthless warrior and founder of the largest contiguous empire in history, but was also a prolific father as well as siring so many children that one in 200 men around the world are reportedly directly descendant from him. Reason why I skipped that period is because siring was not capitalized, but who the hell cares about grammar or proper writing or anything. Okay, so back. It tells you a little bit of the history about Genghis Khan. Of course, has some illustrations, some interesting graphs and stuff. And I found that story kind of entertaining because I did mention that not too long ago on the show. A couple other things that I have mentioned over time. Kim Jong-un every now and then has to pop back up in the news. And I turn to the AP here, which I'm going to turn to many times during this hour. But here's one story that I bet you missed. Everybody wants to talk about the missiles, the possibility of missiles, what weapons are being tested by North Korea. They are the threat that comes out every once in a while just to remind you that there are global threats to democracy because they're, one of those commie nations that could cause a brand new domino effect and all that good stuff. I mean, the boogeyman that nobody really buys, because how can you take a guy who looks like that seriously? Well, this is a headline, let's see, which was from May 13th, actually, and I held on to it because I just didn't know what to do with the story, but you're going to see the point of why I'm bringing it up soon. Kim Jong, this is the headline from AP.com, APnews.com, actually. Kim Jong-un lookalike disrupts Australian election campaign. Remember, we were discussing the Australian election process not too long ago, and I have brought up Kim Jong-un and the significance of pulling this guy out as the off-the-shelf occasional boogeyman to scare people who are completely ignorant about what's what. Well, anyway, Sydney, according to the AP, the Dateline Sydney, a man impersonating North Korean leader Kim Jong-un on Friday, and that would be that Friday, I guess around the 13th. Let's see. When is that exactly? Oh, it was the 13th. Okay. So it was reported on the 13th and Friday. They always put that in there. Anyway, Friday disrupted the Australian election campaign when he burst into an event that Prime Minister Scott Morrison was attending with lawmaker Gladys Liu. The impersonator, who later identified himself by the stage name Howard X, started talking to gathered media. Quote, "Thank you very much. Gladys Liu is the communist candidate for Australia," end quote, he said, before he was interrupted by an aide to Morrison. Quote, "Excuse me, you're going to have to leave. This is the most offensive thing I have ever seen in a campaign," said the aide. That's in quotes. Nick Creevy, C-R-E-V-E-Y. Okay. The impersonator responded, quote, "Excuse me, you don't tell the Supreme Leader what to do. I support Gladys Liu," end quote. The impersonator left the Melbourne venue soon after. In a statement to the Associated Press, Liu said she was focused on delivering outcomes for the Melbourne communities she represents. Quote, "I will not be distracted by my opponents and their grubby tactics," she said. Liu was born in Hong Kong and has lived in Australia for more than 30 years. The disruption appeared to have been orchestrated in part by Longshot Queensland State Senate candidate Drew Pavlou, P-A-V-L-O-U, who said on social media that he was good friends with Howard X and it was, quote, "one of the best things we have ever managed." Okay, so Pavlou had earlier claimed in posts that Liu had defended China's leadership and had ties to the regime. Pavlou described himself as, quote, "young Larkin," end quote, who thought the election was boring and needed more excitement. During the event at Extel Technologies in Melbourne, Morrison praised Chinese Australians. Quote, "I talk about the assertive and aggressive nature of the Chinese government, not the Chinese people, end quote, Morrison said. Quote, you know, Chinese Australians are the greatest patriots you could hope for in this country, end quote. Okay, so why do I bring this to your attention? And should I keep reading it? I guess I'll finish it out. It's not too much longer. The disruption came at a time of heightened tensions between Australians and China, most recently over a security pact that China signed with the Salmon Islands. Howard X is well known for his impersonation of Kim Jong-un in 2018. He was detained and questioned when he arrived in Singapore days before a summer between the summit between the North Korean leader and U.S. President Donald Trump. His real name is Lee Howard Ho-Wung. Media reported the impersonator was being interviewed by police on Friday. Australia's elections will be held on May 21st. This is, of course, written on the 13th. And early voting begins this week. Opinion polls have the center-left opposition Labour Party tracking ahead of Morrison's conservative coalition. Now, I'm sure the suggestion here in this article is really that because you have an Asian descendant in Australia running in government, that this was done because of the Asian Association and tying someone who is Asian to China and then tying them, of course, to North Korea is all a grubby tactic, as she said, right? So I imagine that's the inference here, but nobody's saying it outright. It's kind of funny, kind of chaotic, but also, yeah, I get it. It is kind of grubby, too. It would be like, you know, sending... Well, anyway, I don't need... Do I need to draw a metaphoric relationship and come up with something hypothetical to explain this? I think you guys are smart enough to get it. Anyway, I thought it was an interesting story, nevertheless. So, let's see. We could go to a couple of other stories of curiosity, but let's get back to something else that that I told you was coming at a certain point. And this is also from the AP, but this is, let's see, I think it's from today. And what does it have to do with? Well, monkeypox. Now, I brought that up on the show, and a couple of listeners actually kind of made the point. I don't know if they actually made the point, but they kind of made the point that maybe I was making that up, that monkeypox is not really a thing. Monkeypox, by the way, not muckypox. Anyways, monkeypox. Now I've seen a couple of reports on it. The AP is in on it. I've seen it on a couple of other channels. They're introducing it in there along with the, hey, don't forget COVID might resurge in a lot of places. But here's the headline. U.S. case of monkeypox reported in Massachusetts man. This is from the AP today. Again, apnews.com, right? And all these notes will be in with the show along with some other background material I've read just so you guys can read it too. Anyway, and notice Jack had talked about, you know, New York, it's back, it's back. Well, guess what else is in New York? Dateline New York, AP again. And this article is authored by Mike Stobe, S-T-O-B-B-E. But anyways, Massachusetts, it says New York, AP, by the way. Massachusetts on Wednesday reported a rare case of monkeypox in a man who recently traveled to Canada. And health officials are looking into whether it is connected to small outbreaks in Europe. Monkeypox is typically limited to Africa, and rare cases in the U.S. and elsewhere are usually linked to travel there. A small number of confirmed or suspected cases have been reported this month in the United Kingdom, Portugal, and Spain. Then they give you a little explainer on monkeypox. All right, which I'm not going to go into. But anyway, U.S. health officials said they are in contact with officials in the U.K. and Canada as part of the investigation. But, but at this point in time, we don't have any information that links the Massachusetts case to the U.K., said Jennifer McQuinton of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Though it's the only U.S. case the CDC is aware of, quote, I do think we are preparing for the possibility of more cases, she said. So, you know, am I crazy? Did I bring it up? Was I making jokes? Maybe. Maybe I was making jokes about it, but I'm not kidding as to why I bring these things up to you guys, okay? There are a couple of other articles on monkeypox I could get into, but I almost think they want to see, they want to float it out there. little test subject. See if they can sell you that next as the grand disease coming to kill us all, because we are in end times, and you want to be, you know, you want to be fully having the plagues in play, because, I mean, we need famine, we need plagues, we need starvation, we're going to need some war. And, you know, if you bring it all together enough and you cook that soup together, a lot of people will start screaming Book of Revelations. So, you know, either by design or because it's useful to have people in that mindset one way or another. End times, get ready for it. I mean, if you got nothing to live for because there is no tomorrow, you know, it might change your behavior patterns. But pay no attention to that, because does the news actually report what goes on? I mean, in the case of the never-ending wars, do they ever end? And this is a question that I have, because I read a few articles this week also, one of them more concisely put together from justsecurity.org. Okay, justsecurity.org. And this one is the headline, by the way. Let's see, Crispin Smith is the author, and it was published on the 18th. So here we are, still at war, : the United States in, ready, Iraq. Okay. Editor's note, this article is in 6 installments in our Still at War symposium, which can be accessed here. They give you a link. I'm not going there. Anyway, almost 20 years have passed since the United States invaded Iraq to topple Saddam Hussein. After the invasion, U.S. forces remained in Iraq for 8 years before withdrawing in 2011, only to return in 2014 to fight a new terrorist threat from the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS. Today's counter-ISIS mission in Iraq, ongoing since 2014, rests on a strong international legal basis, relying on Iraqi consent along with the principle of self-defense and the support of the UN Security Council. Period. Okay. I like how we install a government and then we say, well, that government consented. Yeah, the people that we put in place, they agreed with us. It's all good. It's all good, man. Anyway. Let's see, strong international legal base. Right, they start a sentence here with but, so I'll go back to the article. But U.S. domestic authorization has grown tenuous, based, and now in parentheses, like so many other current U.S. conflicts, end parentheses, on stretched interpretations of the 2001 and 2002 authorizations for use of military force, the latter of which dates back to the 2003 Iraq War itself. Meanwhile, the legal basis for recent U.S. military actions against Iranian-backed groups in Iraq is questionable as a matter of domestic and international law. While policy, imperatives, imperatives to keep limited military, okay, while policy imperatives to keep military limited forces in Iraq remain, it is crucial to reevaluate the legal basis and policy objectives for continuing U.S. military operations there. And then the next sub headline here is how the counter-ISIS campaign in Iraq began. In 2011, President Barack Obama announced the withdrawal of U.S. military forces from Iraq, fulfilling his campaign promise to the end of the Iraq War that began under the Bush administration in 2003. But just 3 years later, U.S. troops returned, responding to the rapid advances of widely publicized atrocities of ISIS, at the head of a coalition of allied nations known as the Combined Joint Task Force, Operation Inherent Resolve, and its and in close support of Iraqi and local forces, including Kurdish forces, in parentheses, the United States played a pivotal role in liberating vast swaths of territory from ISIS, degrading its capabilities and preventing it from continuing to commit gross violations of international humanitarian law against local populations. By 2017, ISIS no longer held territory in Iraq, and the Iraqi security forces, ISF, supported by C/TF, right, CJTF, excuse me, had liberated ISIS's last stronghold in the city of Mosul, Iraq's second largest city and ISIS's de facto capital in Iraq. U.S. support for the operations played a decisive role in achieving that victory, contributing to ISIS's territorial defeat. Since 2017, the United States has retained a limited military presence in Iraq, mostly to train, advise, and support local forces, which continue to perform counterterrorism operations while ISIS no longer holds territory, it rapidly has demonstrated an ability to resurge, temporarily taking control of towns and villages, or carrying out successful attacks against the ISF. For the most part, Iraqi atrocities continue to see... Iraqi authorities continue to see the need for and support a limited continued U.S. military presence. But some local actors, particularly Shiite militia groups supported by Iran, have long objected to any U.S. military presence in Iraq. As the ISIS threat recedes, these domestic groups increasingly have called for the United States to leave or be expelled from Iraq. So there is more on the current involvement in Iraq in that story and in that series. I certainly advise you to read it for yourself. But funny how these guys tell us these conflicts are over and they keep rolling over into new conflicts with new justifications. And I could have swore somebody said around 2017 that ISIS was entirely destroyed. But when you need them to, they can pop up, resurge, take over a place, and justify the presence and continued use of military force in places like that, where I'm sure nobody is getting killed as they train, advise, and even participate in these operations, right? I'm not reading from the article. I'm just talking to you here. Anybody want to consider this? Nah, why pay attention to that? I mean, we've got Ukraine. There's another war zone we can pay attention to. Why pay attention to the other places on the planet where shots are being fired and guaranteed there's quietly some loss of life guaranteed? Nope, pay no attention. See how these things just don't ever seem to end? I mean, Vietnam, we actually left. Afghanistan, we might have left. I mean, I know it's bad, but I just mentioned two terrible withdrawals. But either way, we kind of left. Although, stay tuned. We might still be in Afghanistan, right? Because they never really tell you exactly what's going on. Just like we weren't in Syria, we were drawn from most of the area, and then suddenly we were involved in, guess what, some other thing. Oh, we killed, the third or fourth person that we decided headed some group. Oops. I didn't mean to say we were involved in the decision directly of the terrorist group. Not a we in general or not a publicly known we, but guaranteed our intelligence agencies had a vote. So, you know, I mean, how many times can you kill Baghdadi before somebody recognizes you're actually beating a dead horse? Anyway, let's change away from warfare and all that just for a second, because this is all going to come together in my mind about how it is we're constructing the newest narrative for the latest conflict between Eurasia and Oceania, because that is the game. It'll be the rumors of wars, it'll be the lack of war, and then it'll be the moments of hate that bring you together, because we're going to remain on the divisive plane here in the great states. This land is your land. This land ain't nobody's land. From California to the whole damn East Coast. All right, let's get into some more fun stuff from the AP just to show you the wide range of weirdness they have. This is from March 17th, okay? And it's, this is a North Carolina story. I definitely thought of BP when I pulled this one. Anyways, Elizabeth City, North Carolina, that's the dateline from the AP, and I don't see an author or a byline, so AP staff, I guess. Anyway, Elizabeth City, North Carolina is the dateline. North Carolina regulators were wrong to reject a beer label that featured a silhouette of a naked man standing next to a campfire, a federal judge has ruled. The owners of Maryland-based Flying Dog Brewery argued that the North Carolina Alcohol Beverage Control Commission violated their First Amendment rights by rejecting the label for its Freezin' Season Winter Ale. The commission had said the label was in bad taste, but later allowed the beer to be sold. Flying Dog proceeded with the lawsuit anyway, hoping to get the regulation struck down. U.S. District Judge Terrence W. Boyle ruled in favor of the craft brewery last week, finding that the regulation, was vague and overbroad. I never heard that before. Okay, anyway. Violating the free speech rights of Flying Dog and its competitors. The ruling requires North Carolina to remove the current regulation. Flying Dog CEO Jim Caruso said it was heartening to see such a court decision. Let me pause for a second. Why is the wording and use of word, you know, verbiage and things in this so strange? Is it just me? Am I getting old? All right, quote, "The First Amendment is the last defense against authoritarian and arbitrary government, and it must be protected against any and all threats," Caruso said in a statement Monday. That was in quotes, by the way. Pausing from the article again, First Amendment rights for a corporation, a company. Anyway. Back to this, and in quotes again, "The NCABC Commission respects Judge Boyle's decision and appreciates his time and consideration in hearing this case," end quote. Commission spokesperson Jeff Strickland said in an email to the Associated Press on Tuesday, quote, "NCABC Commission staff are reviewing the decision to determine the appropriate next steps." This is not the first time Flying Dog has gone to court over its labels. A federal appeals court ruled in favor of the brewery in 2015 regarding a ban of the sale of its Raging Bitch beer in the state of Michigan. News outlets reported the dispute began in 2009 when a board determined the label to be, quote, "determinal to it, to the health, safety, or welfare of the general public," end quote. The label featured a drawing of a female dog with accentuated features, bared teeth, and a tongue covered in blood. Both of the labels were created by artist Ralph Steadman, who frequently collaborated with Hunter S. Thompson, the founder of Gonzo Journalism. Anyway, I find that story interesting, and yeah, so the same company got in trouble for the bear thing, which, you know, sounds to me like winter, and it's a vaguely veiled sort of reference to gay guys, I guess. The other thing there is, what, offensive to women, but it's Flying Dog beer after all, and among the flying dogs there might be a bitch. You know, a female in heat, I guess. Are females in heat allowed to be flying dogs? Well, according to some, yes. According to others, no. So sticking with the AP once again, it's still at apnews.com. Just beer news. Can you tell I need a drink? Anyway, beer news. And this one was also published today, but we have an author here, Jerry Tanner. And Finland Brewery launches NATO beer with taste of security. Why is beer like this? Seriously, like, does beer need to be this gimmicky to get you to drink it? Either you drink beer or you don't. I mean, all right, enough out of me. This dateline is Helsinki, AP. A small brewery in Finland has launched a NATO-themed beer to mark the Nordic country's bid to join the Western Military Alliance. Olaf Ruig's Otan Lager features a blue label with a cartoon version of a beer-drinking medieval knight in metal armor, emblazoned with NATO's compass symbol. The beer's name is a play on the Finnish expression Oran Olutra. I probably just said that wrong. That's in quotes, but sorry. Which means I'll have a beer. And the French abbreviation for NATO, which is OTAN, O-T-A-N. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization has two official languages, English and French. CEO Petteri Vantanen, V-A-N-T-I-N-E-N, told the Associated Press on Thursday that the craft brewery's ad hoc decision last week to start producing the beer was motivated by, quote, worries over the war in Ukraine, end quote, and its consequences for Finland. The new lager as having, quote, a taste of security with a hint of freedom. Finland and Sweden on Wednesday submitted an application to join NATO at the alliance headquarters in Brussels. Olaf Brurig said, its new beer also honors the eastern Finnish town of Sovonlinna. S-O-V-O-N-L-I-N-N-A. The brewery's base, located a few dozen kilometers from Finland's border with Russia. Sovonlinna is known for St. Olaf's Castle, a medieval structure from 1475 that serves as a venue for an international opera festival. So, let's see, a couple other comments down here at the bottom. Our small hometown, Sovonlinna, has also lied in the borderlands between East and West. Many battles have been fought in the town area and at St. Olaf Castle, the brewery said in a Twitter post. Finland shares a 1,340-kilometer, or 830-mile, border with Russia, the longest of any European Union member. So, lots of interesting factoids there. And isn't it curious that the AP has all this time for beer news? So, why don't we switch from... Yeah, here we go. We'll switch from beer to... how about drugs? This one I found interesting over at, let's see, insightcrime.org. Okay? Insight is not insight. It's insight as in looking into or an ability to look inside of something. Insight, okay? Insightcrime.org. And here's the headline that caught my attention. Can Peru counter drug trafficking by buying all the coca? This is written by Gabrielle Corder. And it was published on the 17th of May. Anyways, again, all these links will be in with the show notes from tonight when I'm done, along with a lot of other stuff, so you can follow up and read some of these things that I may just excerpt a bit myself here. But I found this to be a curious thing that nobody's talking about. Anyway, a government proposal for Peru to purchase all of the country's coca production has generated fierce debate. But experts question whether it is even feasible. In its first year in power, the administration of President Pedro Castillo has advocated for legalizing and industrializing coca. Peru's chief of staff, Anibal Torres, took a bold step recently by declaring that Peru's government should purchase coca from legal and illegal growers alike. Quote, it is essential to prevent social conflict to buy coca leaves for at least a year from current registered producers and those who decide to participate, end quote, Torres stated during a cabinet meeting in late April. After Torres' announcement, local media reported a plan for the state-owned national coca company, Empresa Nacional de la Coca, okay, to produce coca beyond 2,500 tons of leaves it already buys each year from 95,000 registered growers. The coca sold by that organization, ENACO, which has commercialized coca in Peru since 1982, is for traditional uses, including leaves for chewing, teas, flour, and other products such as liquor. ENACO. However, produces just a fraction of the coca cultivated in the country. There are some 400,000 unregistered growers in Peru, which produce an estimated 160,000 tons of leaves per year, according to the information reported by Peruvian media outlet Justian. Following an interview with Ruben Vargas, the former head of the National Commission for Development and Life Without Drugs, Vida Sin Drugs de Vida, while some is solid and consumed for traditional purposes, as estimated, 90% of the coca refined for cocaine, feeding the drug trade, according to the information provided to El Comercio by Vargas in 2020, the U.S. White House Office of National Drug Control Policy estimated cocaine production in Peru to be about 810 metric tons, making it the world's largest coca producer behind Colombia. So they're the second. Okay. Let's see. The purchase of illegal coca is meant to be a step toward wearing the country's illicit growers off the weaning the country's illicit growers off the crop in exchange for investing in alternative development and social programs and other public services in coca growing regions. Cultivators in these areas must commit to not planting new coca crops or engaging in illicit activities. According to Torres, the goal is to have coca growers reduce crops by some 1,000 hectares during the first year. The recent coca proposal comes after official statements about shifts to Peru's anti-drug efforts, in the Arapamec, Ene, and Mantara rivers. Okay, the Valles de los Rios Aputunac and Ye Mantara. Okay, one of the country's top growing coca producing regions. Peru's Minister of the Interior, Luis Barazuela, said in October that coca eradication efforts would be suspended. Okay. Meanwhile, the Castillo administration is also proposing the demilitarization of this jungle region, where the Mayos guerrilla group and Sendero Luminoso still maintains a presence. In late April, Peru's defense minister, Jose Luis Gavida, said that the government plans to close some 40 military bases in that region. The Castillo administration has advocated for moving the troops from this area to Madre de Dios, a region in southern Peru plagued by illegal mining. So anyway, they go into some more analysis and all that, but I find that interesting when one government decides it wants to buy the illegitimate crops and put them forth for some legitimate use, allegedly. Can you get rid of that much in your alcoholic beverages? Are we about to have a new Peruvian beverage renaissance if they pull this off? Is this just virtue signaling? Is this just their version of the war on drugs? Well, I guess I got a lot of questions here, and they're not going to be answered all in this article, that's for sure. But who knows what'll happen there, because a lot of these narco states, and this is obviously not from an article or anything, but a lot of these narco states appear to make moves toward eradicating the very profitable business that is there for certain regions. And we see how well that turns out in places like Mexico, where there are plenty of people getting executed. I'm seeing also in Ecuador, El Salvador, there are all sorts of law enforcement people who might be going in with the most honest of intentions in order to change the narco state orientation of its people and many regions in their own homelands. Yeah, they tend to either get killed, derailed, paid off. One way or another, I gotta tell you, I don't think the flow of drugs is going to stop. Even if you try and eradicate the coca plants in Peru, Colombia will still keep doing what it does. Nobody says a word about any of that still, right? And they're the number one producer of that. And meanwhile, cocaine, not the featured drug at the moment globally. Why do I say that? Because in the U.S. it's not like that. I mean, perhaps in other countries, cocaine plays a much larger role in the illicit drug trade, but and I know it's still profitable, that's for certain. But I mean, how do you beat the durable and much more profitable by metric ton effectiveness of heroin? How do you do that? I mean, I'm asking that as an open question. Look, if you're thinking about this from a perspective of, well, you know, we need to get rid of all the drugs. Yeah, okay, good luck. But people are always going to seek something. I got to tell you, I alcohol is more destructive, right? And all of the wonderful GMO'd manipulated stuff, and every time somebody comes up with a new concoction to simulate a natural product one way or another, I mean, see the opioid crisis. If we just had opium available, maybe it would be different. If it was just, you know, opium. This is what this stuff is. This is what it does. And here are the risks with it. And that's that. Maybe it would be better than, you know, giving out all these patents to these various conglomerates and legalized cartels that we call Big Pharma. Maybe, just maybe, that would work out better. Drug prohibition is obviously a failure. So, I don't know. You know, I know I'm crazy. I'm one of these guys who says, why are we wasting time on this? Because, you know, the war on drugs is a war on people, and it's mostly poor people. And truthfully, it's mostly people that are suffering one way or another. Because I'll tell you, if your day starts and finishes pretty good, and you don't have issues of any kind where, you know, societal pressures, financial problems are hitting you, health issues are hitting you, You generally shouldn't be trained to go reaching for drugs unless something is hurting. Maybe we should address the things that are actually hurting people. Oh, I know, that's such a hippie thing to say. And, you know, you don't want potheads running everything, Chuck. Well, they already do. I don't know anybody. I don't know anybody in almost any position of anything. And I don't know super rich people, so I'm not sure if super rich people outside of Snoop Dogg and well, what was it? Musk smoked weed on Rogan's show, didn't he? I don't know. I guess that's an example of a super rich guy, but I don't know for sure that that wasn't you know, a false flag. I don't know that that wasn't staged, because take a look at his play on Twitter. I gotta say, I would see it as a negotiating tactic if nothing else. What he's pulled off there. So, do I know for a fact that Elon Musk wasn't crisis actoring his... is that a word? Crisis actoring? What is now? Crisis actoring his way through smoking weed on Rogan's show? I don't know. I don't know. Does he actually smoke weed? I believe Snoop Dogg does, and he's pretty rich. But outside of that, I don't know rich people. So, maybe they don't smoke weed, but almost everybody else I know, on one level or another, partakes in cannabis one way or another. And now it's gotten even more, you know, trendy and all that good stuff with CBD, where, you know, people say, look, I'm not being a pothead, I just use the CBD. And indeed, there are useful purposes for CBD and also for THC as medicine. But, you know, you start trying to pull the THC out. First of all, you can't get rid of all of it. But when you drop the level of it, you're actually taking away various elements of the plant that could be helpful to most of the very things that people are taking the CBD for. But I know when you want to give it to little kids for seizures and stuff, maybe you don't want them getting high off of their medicine. I know. And maybe some people don't like it when other people get high. I know. And, well, what about the dangers? And, look, alcohol is sold everywhere legally. All you got to do is have a face be 21. There is no prohibition against selling it to a felon. I mean, felons can always be alcoholics all day long. Anyway, if you buy the stuff that they tax heavily, I mean, it's all good. But don't you dare pick up another drug that might work for you. It might be less toxic. I mean, cannabis. I don't know anybody who's ever died of cannabis use directly. You know, actions associated with cannabis use, sure. I'm sure that there are some people that have smoked too much weed, crashed their car. I know that. But what I'm saying is there's no, like, overdose deaths from it. Alcohol poisoning is a thing. You know, various other drugs, people OD, they take too much, you know, their heart gives in, they suddenly discover defects when they are pressure tested. Things like this happen. I've known people, I've sadly buried people who have gone that way. Maybe I've happily buried a couple of people who have gone that way. But anyhow, it is what it is. People are going to seek to feel something other than what they're feeling if what they're feeling sucks. Am I oversimplifying this? Perhaps. Anyway, let's look at the other life's blood, because I'll tell you something. When it comes to the life's blood of everything, and I do mean everything, some people would say politics is in everything, and they are right, but it's really just the dirty byproduct of the business that needs to get done one way or another, whether it's criminal, legitimate, or, you know, somewhere in between. You know, most of the world lies in gray areas, not black and white, no matter how those racists want to categorize it. just save your hate mail. Don't send it. Don't send it. If you want to send a donation, blindjfkresearcher@gmail.com is my PayPal address, as well as my personal email. You can also send messages anyway to info@ocelli.com, but save your hate mail. I really don't want to read it. I don't care at this point. Hate me all day. Call me names, whatever. I'll probably respond to you, actually, and tell you thanks for listening, but, you know, you don't accomplish anything else other than a little smile from me that I irritated somebody. So if that's what you want to do, go ahead and email me, message me. Links are available at ocelli.com. Anyhow, this is the story I want to close on because I was a little confused by this. See, I'm watching the oil business emerge and, of course, the Russian-Ukraine conflict, which everybody knows where I'm at on that if you listen to this show. What can I say? I really am not on board with the idea that even military conflict is necessary if we could mature as a species, but, you know, again, all that hippie crap, right? So as I sit here sweating to death because I don't want to run my air conditioner during my solo hour, I might have to turn it on, though, in just a minute because I am really literally covered in sweat. It does make me think of energy and the various debates where people get lost in the labyrinthian mazes of the conflict in Ukraine with Russia, with the EU, with what does this mean for NATO? Why is the U.S. gas price going up, and how does that suck for you? I know it sucks for me. I cannot believe the cost of some things. I mean, literally... I'm just by price can't do certain things when it comes to food. I'm considering every move being made because of the gas it costs. It is absolutely horrendous, and I know I shouldn't even be complaining, right? I shouldn't even be complaining because I'm still dealing with that and car repairs and God knows what. Everything, you know, doubling, tripling in price, but people telling me there's only about 9% inflation. Yeah. Anyhow, I like this headline, and this comes from a source I usually don't like to use, but again, this came to my attention. And why does it come to my attention? Because I'm seeing a pattern emerge here. And the pattern I'm seeing is the next major global conflict being orchestrated from various directions. And this is part of the theme from yesterday where I talked about the resurgence of the war on terror, which, by the way, apologies for the strangeness in my enunciation. I bit the hell out of the side of my mouth, and it is swollen really bad. So occasionally I'm going to mispronounce a few things. It's going to sound funny. Anyhow, from Bloomberg, Bloomberg.com. Not always the most reliable source, but I found this headline extremely eye-catching. And I'm just going to lay the pieces here and let you figure it out because, you know, you guys are smart enough to do that. I don't have to walk you through and make you try and agree with my opinions. I'm just presenting some evidence for you, and you figure it out. I'm sure you will. Anyway, under the politics subsection in Bloomberg, we have U.S. to ease sanctions on Venezuela, enabling cargoes to Europe. European firms, and these are sub-headlines, European firms operating in-country could send oil immediately. Decision doesn't allow Chevron to drill or export oil. Anyway, this is by, apparently has multiple authors here, so I don't know if I'm going to get all the way through this, but it was published on May 17th at 1:27 p.m. Eastern Time. And updated again at 5:36 p.m. And the multiple authors, Jennifer Jacobs, Daniel Flatley, Justin Sink, and Fabola Zerpa. There's a handle for you. Anyway, let's begin with the article. The Biden administration plans to ease sanctions on Venezuelan oil in a bid to bring more of the country's crude to Europe. The U.S. will allow European companies still operating in Venezuela to divert more oil to the continent immediately, while Chevron will be allowed to negotiate a resumption of operations in the country, according to a person familiar with the matter who spoke on condition of anonymity to detail the plans. I always love when they have the on condition of anonymity, I'll give you the lowdown, and that's all they got. Anyway, the U.S.-backed Venezuelan opposition supports the move, the person said. The eating of penalties, the easing of penalties come as a tightening global oil supplies send the cost of crude and fuels skyward, threatening to worsen already historic inflation. More barrels from Venezuela would help alleviate the supply crunch while also aiding Europe in weaning itself from Russian energy and the superpower's invasion of Ukraine. U.S. benchmark crude fell on the news. The move is meant to facilitate negotiations between the government of President Nicolas Maduro, here's that guy again, and the American-backed opposition, according to a second person who spoke on condition of anonymity. I'm sorry, they have two anonymous sources. Anyway, back to the article. But it's politically contentious, with some lawmakers arguing that the move only bolsters Maduro's regime. Italy's Enespa and Spain's Reposal Esse are the only major European oil producers with operations in the country. They are working with the Biden administration to divert Venezuelan oil bound for China to Europe, one of the people said. While Chevron currently isn't allowed to drill for or export oil from Venezuela, the resumption of talks with state-owned PDVSA paves the way for the San Ramon, California-based company to obtain a new license allowing it to resume operations. It also signals that Venezuelan oil may be coming to the U.S., one person said. Let me stop right here. So they're going to turn the Venezuelan spigot back on. You know why they're going to do that? Because it's highly profitable for all the people that have their hands in it. That's why. It's got nothing to do with alleviating the price. If you think, even if they got Venezuela running at warp speed tomorrow, you're not getting a price break on that. First of all, it would take probably, even with, I mean, unless there's been a whole lot of work already behind the scenes to get this rolling, and they're just making a vague announcement now with, you know, sources that won't even identify themselves, I think they're just floating the idea, really, to see if people will be supportive of it, and perhaps they'll get other subsidies, right? Because they'll be doing a service. Hey, listen, if you let us drill in Venezuela again, we'll be doing a service for the general overall market by bringing new oil in, which will be a lot better and more plentiful than what we're getting from the Saudis, who won't even return Biden's calls. It is hilarious, the shell game that they're playing with this oil business now. I mean, the whole reality boils down to the fact that the price, the metric for the price on the commodity broke. And when it did, people lost so much money that they got, they decided they had to, A, sate their stockholders, and B, you know, wait until you see the big payoffs that every single corporate officer is going to get at each of these major energy producers. Same time, it also will justify, because of the general ecosystem of energy, it's going to justify those massive increases on your electric bill, which they told you about before. Now they can blame it on the Ukraine war and supply shortages, even though, you know, your electricity is not delivered by a truck. But it's okay. It'll cost more because we're delivering it. They've been doing that. They've been price gouging you. They have continuously done it. They blame it on everything else in the world outside of what it is, which is corporate raiders raiding you instead of other corporations. Well, perhaps it is that they are raiding the corporation, and the corporation is the one that's supposed to be serving you. Is that the way that works? Either way, unjustified profiteering off of an economically vulnerable situation. Supply chain issues, absolutely. Baby formula, I'd be pissed if I had a baby right now. Because it seems like the stuff has run out everywhere. And the media is you know, the mainstream anyway. And some of the alt media is helping that right along, making sure that scarcity, panic buying, and all that goes on. It's toilet paper 2.0, except this time, if you're somebody that relies on that because of the circumstance, whatever it may be, okay, because I got to tell you, it may be reliant. You can't be changing an infant's formula. I mean, we're going to go back to the days where, quite frankly, because I was born addicted, had to have a special formula created for me because I couldn't tolerate anything. My parents used to have to make it. Maybe I'll give a recipe for that. If anybody wants it, let me know. I'll give you the recipe for what they gave to the dope sick baby. Because I had some issues. Okay. And it's healthy. It's good. It's good all the way around. I don't think anybody would object to the formula if you needed it in a pinch and you can't get what you're supposed to be able to get, which is what the kid starts out life with. And I understand some people say, well, just breastfeed. Well, you know what? Not convenient, not possible in some cases. And, what are you going to do? Okay, so screw the baby. You can't get the stuff that we have now created a system that you're relying on. No. Pay no attention to that. And, oh, by the way, a tomato is now, what, $3.45? Because that's what a tomato's worth? Are they paying the immigrants to pick them anymore? Are your grapes, which have gone up in price, you think anybody's getting paid more per basket to pick them? You think that's happening? I know the gas costs more to bring it in from wherever the hell it is to you, because nobody wants to locally source, or, well, in some places I wouldn't locally source anything. I mean, if you're in a city, you wouldn't want much of the produce grown there because it's going to be all contaminated, but please, tell me again how these people are not profiting, because it looks to me like, although retail giants just recently were a little bit shook and we had a little stock market dive, nobody's losing money if they're, the personage of a corporation. But if you're a man or a woman standing on the land, you're getting hit. Anyway, in the next hour, I'll be talking to Joseph L. Flatley about, guess what? The failed state. The failed state update. Update in the second hour of the Ocelli Effect. And I want to remind you guys also that your help, as always, is necessary. And I do accept PayPal donations. And sadly, yes, the cost of everything has gone up, including running this. So challenges. And I know you're facing them, too. We'll get through it together. Stick.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough.
Maybe you're thinking about getting started.
WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Go there now.
Go there now.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
Support Chuck O'Chilly and Chili.com.
There's no money in it, so
yeah, that's the
problem.
That's the biggest problem, I think. And, you know, some people would say that, look, you're in an age when you can be independently supported, but quite frankly, I'm on that business model, too. And, look, I'm not going to complain, but I'm going to complain. Okay, because people want to support you. They love you to death, but honestly.
So if you're listening in, this is a very unsubtle request to support the damn show. And I want you to do this, too, because, the Ochelli Report is one of the few places where Greg Palast can get his stuff out. I mean, you'll still see my bylines in some of these outlets, but nevertheless, I used to be a regular on CNN and on MSDNC, but no more.
Revelation through conversation.
Ochelli.com.
The views expressed by callers, co-hosts, or anyone else who happens to get on the air at Ochelli.com do not necessarily reflect the views of Ochelli.com or Chuck Ochelli, and we are not responsible for any stupidity which might ensue. Thank you.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to Larry-Hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at Amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Ochelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Second hour of the Ochelli Effect begins now at Ochelli.com. But of course, you could be hearing this some other time, some other place. I mean, as I speak, by the way, it is just after 9 p.m. Eastern here in what we used to call America. To me, a failing state. Oh, coincidentally, I have the guy from the failed state update to give us the failed state update. Joseph L. Flatley, author, journalist, kind of quirky guy in general, who I appreciate. You know, I brought you up to... A filmmaker recently, who was talking about doing certain stuff, and I said, you know, I know this author who has, if you wanted to do these short films on very odd subjects, I got one guy for you.
Nice.
I said, Joseph L. Flatley, if you really wanted to do these films, I bet you he would work with you. I mean, you know, I wasn't trying to volunteer you for work.
Oh,
but,
no, dude. That's funny. Know. Yeah, I mean, I love short films, experimental films. I don't do nearly enough of that. I'm one of my side hustles is I edit a website called Payday Report, which is like an independent labor union news site. Mm. And it's actually really cool because it's like, it's truly independent. Like, they call out the unions just as much as they call out management. If the unions, like, they got a lot of heat for like exposing sexual misconduct in the labor union, in the labor movement, which, you know, then like the wagons, you know, draw in, and they don't want to, people say, well, you know, you're going to hurt the labor movement if you, you know, bring up these misdeeds. But it's like, the only way to have a strong labor movement is to keep it honest, keep it clean. And so as a Payday Report editor / cameraman, I was like one of the two only journalists at this like meeting that Bernie Sanders had with striking Starbucks workers here in Pittsburgh last week. And it's like, and it was a lot of fun. I'm a terrible cameraman, by the way. If anybody needs one, don't call me.
Okay. So,
but you know, if you're super desperate, I can't hold the thing, but
yeah, but that's kind of like hiring me as a cameraman. Probably not a good idea. It's okay, though. You should drop a link in our Skype chat to that website, though, so I don't forget about it. I'll include it with the show notes.
Oh, yeah. That'd
because
be great.
I'd love for people to even look at a publication that is actually independent. Even if it has a narrow focus, it would be a good point of reference and wouldn't mind promoting it. So, yeah, go ahead and give me that link in the Skype chat. But, you know, I want to get at some other stuff. The reason why I brought you up to the filmmaker, honestly, is because he was looking for ideas, and he mentioned The Finders.
Mm.
And I said, well, I got the guy for you. You know, and I said, if you want two guys, I'll give you him, and who do you think is the next person I mention?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, this guy wanted, you know, really unusually positioned things, and I said... Uh-huh. Well, you know, Joseph L. Flatley and Adam Go Rightly.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Because, you know, and the other thing is he vaguely mentioned, you know, the Discordian Society as well. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, well, Adam Go Rightly, I'll put you in touch with him and Joseph L. Flatley if you want.
Yeah, so, Adam literally wrote the book on the Discordian.
Yeah, he did.
Society, so.
He absolutely did. And so, you know, again, some people criticize me for, you know, following such things. But but they get way into, you know, Gabriel, right?
Yeah.
They, the so-called prophet from Pittsburgh, that podcast series. Also, you have a book on it, which is available and put out by Feral House. You might want to mention that right here.
Yeah, New Age Grifter, the true story of Gabriel of Urantia and his cosmic family. I went undercover at a UFO cult compound for 5 hours, and that kind of capped off my 5 years of meeting ex-members and investigating and talking to people on the ground and cult insiders and kind of telling the story of this really strange experimental community. I believe it's a destructive cult in southern Arizona.
But it's weirdly stagnant because it doesn't grow.
Uh-huh, right.
It doesn't fall apart, but it also doesn't grow, and, you know, there's no Waco to it.
Right.
It just kind of is, and they oddly have control of, like, a radio station, and what was their catchphrase? I can't even remember what it was, but it was, like, come be with us or something. It was really weird.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, what was it? It's been so long since I've heard it. It's like, we bid thee come or something.
Some weird kind of like, come and join us, but so like weirdly wonky like worded. Like, there we go. I just wonkily worded that. Is it wonkily? Is there wonkily? Is that a word? I don't know.
Well,
you're
well,
the writer.
If something is wonky, it must be wonkily worded.
Must be wonkily worded, right? Okay, well, anyway, you get the point.
Yeah.
So it's really, really strange, and your desire to, you know, also there's what was it? Lucifer goes to the mind control.
Satan goes to the mind control convention about the International Society for the Study of Trauma and Dissociation. So this is an actual medical group, or, you know, professional group for psychologists and therapists who believe in the craziest satanic panic mockingbird, or not mockingbird, but Monarch, Operation Monarch stuff, you know? It's
right.
Just like, you know, stuff that you wouldn't, you know, there's a lot of weird stuff happens in, once you start going into the human brain, but when you go beyond that into the realm of the impossible, like the aliens and the you know, the Satanists and the, you know, and like these people believe it, they promote it. So right. I wrote a book about them and how they kind of are feuding with the Satanic Temple.
Right.
Which is like just a bizarre.
It's just very bizarre. So anyway, that's some of the history. Now, in recent times, if you go to, what is it, failedstateupdate.com,
yeah.
You can subscribe. And also, LennyFlatley.net is still operational, right?
Yeah, it is. I don't know. I feel like it's probably confusing.
Okay, so failed
go there
state,
and it's like, I don't know if I do a good job of telling people to go to Failed State Update, but
okay. So, but if you go to failedstateupdate.com, you can sign up for, you know, and also there's a Patreon and stuff like that, right? Where you can sign up and you can get different versions of the newsletter. I get a version of the newsletter, and I got to tell you some of the recent headlines in the newsletter. So let's go to your recent work. First of all, what the hell? Norman Mailer, how did he come back up? Because he's in one of the headlines from one of the recent newsletters, right?
Uh-huh.
What was that about?
Well, so...
See, well, wait, before you go there, the reason why I ask is, uh-huh. I'll tell you, I found it strange. I did a thing recently with Bob Wilson's show where he had Anthony Summers on, right?
Uh-huh.
And, of course, Anthony was on there promoting his new Netflix thing about Marilyn Monroe, which I have not commented on myself yet, but I produced that show and looked into that stuff, and then I had to relive a few things and go back over a few things in case I did participate in that show. And one of them is Norman Mailer's work on Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
And Mailer is a weird character. I mean, he did a book on Lee Harvey Oswald, too. You know?
Yeah, he did. And there's a lot of controversy around that one because
right.
he, you know, he was convinced, you know, he is a novelist primarily in his brain. And what I mean by that is he did a lot of journalism. He revolutionized journalism in a lot of ways.
Right.
But he wasn't approaching it as like, you know, as you know, as analytically as a lot as like traditional reporters have to.
Okay.
He kind of always viewed the world as one big novel. You know, he always attacked things from the point of view of, you know, what makes the most sense in a narrative way or in an artistic way or a poetic sense. So he was always drawn to conspiracism in the sense that he like. He was one of the people who backed the Fifth Estate. Remember that,
right?
And he weighed in on the CIA. Became fascinated by the CIA and the JFK assassination, and was convinced that the JFK assassination, you know, was a conspiracy. Or he felt that there must be. I don't know if he was convinced. So after the fall of the Soviet Union, him and now his buddy's name is I'm losing it. Larry Lawrence Schiller went to the USSR, and you know, Lawrence Schiller was a he's very problematic if you start looking in these conspiracies. But he was also a producer, so he you know, would create these projects and fund them or find funding for them, and Norman Mailer would write them.
Right.
So one of them was this, you know, this trip to Russia to, like, basically read all the KGB reports on Lee Harvey Oswald. And he came out of that trip convinced that Lee Harvey Oswald could have killed Kennedy himself and probably did.
Yeah. Oswald's Tale was the name of that book. And what's funny is, here's a weird thing about that, right? Mm-hmm. That a friend of Oswald's who had befriended him when he lived in Minsk did a lot of the same thing. He took his own stuff, his own observations, his own historical, you know, diary pieces, letters between him and Oswald. And then he went to the KGB archives as well, because that's where they are in Minsk, right? You know, which is today modern Belarus. Mailer, I think when he went, it was still the Soviet Union, wasn't it? Or maybe it was just after.
I think it just can't. It was like in the process of collapsing. It was like it was like after. It was very early days, I believe.
Well, either way, Ernst Titovits was the name of this guy. He was a brilliant bio scientist and doctor. Was, you know, knew Oswald while he was there. He was a student and actually audio taped a bunch of things with him, trying to pick up from a Native American speaker English. And it's very interesting. He's got hours and hours of tapes, actually, that nobody's ever heard still, because he doesn't want to pay to have them transferred over. And he said if somebody would put some money in, I would do it. Might give a serious psychological study. But he did a whole thing. It's called Oswald's Russian Adventure or something like that. And it's a much more compelling, much more deeply investigative book than Mailer did. And Mailer was well-funded. This guy did it on his own. It was very weird. Anyway, I just bring that up as a bookend to what Mailer does, because Mailer, again, with Oswald's Tale, becomes part of the pro-Warren Commission sort of literature in the case. Now, I know I'm belaboring this for a minute, but I'm just giving people a background in case people go, well, you know, Norman Mailer, I mean, might be some younger people out there don't have any idea who he is. So I just wanted to give a little bit of contextual clues about the oddity of this gentleman. But even stranger was this headline from your newsletter. So now go ahead into that, because I was like, what? But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so Norman Mailer is the reason I became a writer. You know, it was like I, you know, grew up in the country in rural western Pennsylvania, didn't have any, like, you know how everybody seems to have a story about that teacher that took them under their wing and changed their lives, and I didn't have that. Nobody cared what I did. So it's like I was very old until I realized I could actually be a writer, and the thing that made me want to be a writer was Norman Mailer. So when I was talking to George Petty, who's the son of the founder of this cult, for lack of a better term, or communal group called the Finders, and he mentioned this weird anecdote about Norman Mailer, I was like, I had to write about it. As far as I know, nobody else has heard this story, unless you know George Petty. But
well, that's the thing. I've looked at some of Mailer's weird history, and but there is a great deal of it, and I never heard this before. So yeah, continue.
Well, it's a really very incidental. Like, basically, you know, Norman Mailer in 1960 had a psychotic break and stabbed his wife, almost killed her, and only, like, got out of jail time because his wife refused to testify against him because she didn't want to, like, screw up their kids even more than they already had been. You know, so it was like, so he got a suspended sentence and didn't do any jail time. But, you know, he was kind of like, he had 47, I believe, The Naked and the Dead, which was his, like, World War II novel, was released, and it made him, like, an immediate superstar. You know,
right?
You know, novelists were, like, the, you know, the Instagram influencers of their day, of, you know, the 1940s. It was a huge deal. So he did that, and then proceeded to write a couple little books, and he was kind of, like, washed up by the time he was 40, by, like, 1963. And, you know, his career had, like, a huge resurgence a few years later once he kind of found his footing. But right. for a while, nobody was sure what was going to happen to him. So he drank, he caroused, he hung out with beatniks, he helped found the Village Voice. And at one point, after he was on the, you know, after he had stabbed his wife and been institutionalized, you know, he was in Bellevue for 17 days or something, he shows up at this youth hostel, which Marion Petty, the founder of the Find, who would go on to found the Finders communal movement, had started this youth hostel. And
could you give us a Wikipedia explanation of the Finders in case a listener has no idea what that is?
Yes. So the Finders, founded in the 70s, is a commune run by this guy named Marion Petty, who is a just bizarre, unique, philosophical type guy who developed this system of, like, he called them games, where it was like he had all these people that were, like, part of his movement who, like, worked together communally to pay the rent and stuff, and he would give them, like, weird tasks to do to, like, kind of expand consciousness. Like,
okay.
He would do things like go to leave the house with $10, go to San Francisco, don't come back until you've earned $200 or something, you know, just like weird tasks that would get people out of their comfort zones and kind of blow their minds a little bit, you know. And so this group got a lot of heat in 1987 when, it's a long ass story, but basically they were accused of, like, being a CIA mind control cult.
Okay.
And it was because two of their men were babysitting the children. So this guy, one guy's the father of some of the kids, and then the other guy's helping. And they're babysitting the kids, and somebody in Tallahassee, Florida saw it and thought it looked weird and called the police, and the police jumped to conclusions. And next thing you know, there's national news stories of this group being, you know, a satanic child abuse cult. Mm-hmm. And soon as, like, the police dug into it just the littlest bit, they saw how silly it was, and then, you know, the guys were released and the kids were returned to their parents. But it's become this mainstay in conspiracy culture. Everybody from Nick Bryant to Jason Horsley to, you know, John DeCamp, Ted Gunderson, all talk about this Finders cult as if it's legitimately a CIA mind control cult. And I'm, like, the only person who will say that that's not the case, and I get attacked constantly for being, like, a CIA stooge that loves hurting children.
Oh, right now, but in my chat room, they're talking about, oh, well, you know, they found kiddie porn in their warehouse, and this and that.
Yeah, none of that's true.
Yeah.
People have been repeating lies about this group since 1987.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's, like, it's really just insane. It's, like, it's definitely more toxic than any other story I've ever covered. I definitely went to your live stream and started hearing myself talk.
Whoops.
Yeah, Dave McGowan, did not get to the bottom of the Finders, by the way. I'm gonna actually stop reading this because it's distracted.
Sorry.
So
sorry, I just mentioned it because it was relevant, I thought. And
for sure.
No, look, and McGowan did some interesting work, but, you know, it doesn't mean he was correct about everything. Okay,
go ahead. His books, just, this is a tangent, but it's like, I don't see any consistent argument or well-argued statements in the book, or well-argued, you know, it's really just like, they're really just like brain dumps of, like, facts, rumors, obvious myths, truths, not that he's lying, but that he didn't even catch when someone's lying to him. So it's very difficult to...
Well, see...
If people read that stuff,
yeah,
and they think that's credible, then, you know, they're not going to like anything I write.
Well, no, but at certain points, what happens is that anecdotes come together, and a lot of hearsay comes together, and it's repeated often enough. And you know what? He's not the only writer who's ever fallen victim to this, where it's just like, well, I've heard that a lot of times. Yeah, okay, so where's your evidence for this?
Yeah.
And, you know, Dave had evidence for a lot of interesting things. You know, like some of the stuff about, you know, people in the entertainment business being tied together and being intelligence related. I definitely endorse a lot of that. But some of the stuff, you know, look, working with what you're working with, you don't always get at, you know, oh, I got to this person. Yeah, but sometimes people are telling you stories that have no factual basis. I mean, it just, it occurs. And sometimes it's because they're actually parroting something they've heard.
Yeah, it's really,
you know, hearsay based on hearsay is still, guess what? Hearsay.
It's really hard to, like, you know, parse a lot of this stuff, because stuff feels or seems consistent with reality, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that is a fact that proves anything. Like, I got on this, like, Twitter thread argument with some guy, like, 3 years ago, and every once in a while it pops up. Somebody responds to it. Like, they, like, must be searching for Jonestown and CIA on Twitter or something. And basically he was saying, you know, CIA, Jonestown was a CIA experiment. And I pointed out to him that, like, well, two of the people that know more about Jonestown than anybody have been looking into that seriously since 1970, literally since, like, 2 days after Jonestown happened, and they came to the conclusion that there's no proof. I haven't seen any proof, so I just don't think there's anything to that particular theory. And the guy came back to me, he's like, well, you know, Jim Jones went to Cuba and Brazil. I'm like, what does that mean? Like, and then he said, well, Jim Jones knew Dan Mitrione, who was like the USAID, who was like a, he was like a cop who, like, was tortured and killed by the Tupamaros. Costa Gavras's movie Z, or State of, what is it? State of whatever is based on it. I mean, makes Jones, all these facts make Jones seem really dirty, but there's not one bit of evidence to it that would actually prove anything. It's just,
well,
it's like
Jonestown,
you're dealing with, like, feelings. You're in the realm of, like, feelings and vibes and aesthetics. It's like,
Jonestown,
he's got the spook aesthetic. It's like, well,
yeah. See, I don't entirely object to the idea that it could have been, though, because of some of that stuff. But again, I lean toward the very weird aspects of this, where, you know, you had a guy like Mark Lane was there.
Right.
You know, and you know, some people question that guy's motives, and I don't blame them necessarily, because there are certain points at which you can't figure him out, Mark Lane. You know, even though he's one of the sacred cows in the you know, in the JFK conspiracy culture, you know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, it's very weird, and the fact is, there are some strange connections. This guy knew a lot of very interesting and powerful people. This guy networked, Jim Jones, I'm talking about here,
sure.
And still has a hold on some of these people that survived, you know, till the day they die. You know,
yeah.
even talking, I mean, to, you know, you and I think both talked to Laura Johnston Cole, right?
Yeah, you know, Laura's interesting because I met her a couple years, or probably a few years after you did, and even, like, knowing her for a couple years, she passed away last year, actually.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm saying. But up until her death,
you know, I've interviewed her.
Yeah.
I've been to her house.
Right.
And she's definitely like, this was a cult, you know, they were like, you know, they were doing, you know, mind control, cult mind control on us. But she's still, like, I think you were about to say, she still, you know, thought that there were some good things about Jonestown.
Yeah, like, so, no matter what you said, she would still default back to, look, you know, this was a good thing, a great thing at a certain point. You know, not like it was nefarious all the way through. And to me, I don't see how you could read it that way. Yeah. You know,
well, I mean, it's like, the question is, like, was this a good thing? Or was it, or did somebody use, create a good thing as a power grab to, like, ruin people's lives? You know, it's kind of like, you know, I think it's very possible that, like, Jim Jones could accidentally create something that was, that people got real value out of while playing his twisted mind games and,
right.
You know? So it's kind of like, but yeah, but the Finders.
Yeah, back to the Finders. Let's get back to that because we now, we kind of off-roaded there for a bit. But the Finders are interesting because, again, they prevail still in conspiracy culture, so to speak, as this nefarious organization, which, you know, again, I don't know what the cops ever found. You know, some people would say that, well, that stuff was covered up.
Yeah, well, I mean, the, you know, people have a real kind of twisted, like TV action movie view of how law enforcement works. You know, it's like if the Tallahassee cops and the Washington Metro PD both had it in for the Finders. They knew about them. They didn't like them. Washington Metro had been watching them for years. They had, like, you know, confidential informants who have, like, kept an eye on them. If they could have found any violation whatsoever, they would have railroaded them.
Right.
There was nothing, you know? So, like, so then the question becomes, well, did the CIA shut it down? It's like, CIA doesn't just wander into, like, I mean, the CIA doesn't have the power to shut down a local police investigation. Like, I mean, I'm sure that there's plenty of really, I'm sure there are, you know, moles in police departments that work for the CIA. I'm sure there's some, like, at some level, there's some, like, intersection between the CIA and police. Like, that doesn't, you know, but it's like, the breakdown for the whole system would have to be so absolute for this story to go away, and there would have had to been, you know, 100 people involved in this conspiracy. Maybe your audience believes that that's quite common, but I don't really think it is, you know? I mean, it's like a bunch of jerks that nobody liked. You know, any police, any law enforcement agency would have been happy to throw them to jail if they had any excuse, but yeah. there was nothing. Because they weren't doing what it was said they were doing.
Well, you know, what it is that at a certain point, the FBI had enough influence over local law enforcement to get them to act in certain ways and had people jailed, you know, for reasons that were not quite kosher in a lot of cases. We know about that stuff nowadays. We know about the Secret Service making demands of local PDs to do stuff, and they usually comply.
Right.
You know, so it sounds reasonable, but the CIA doing it is not usually how it goes. It's usually the FBI. I mean, today, currently,
yeah.
It would be more the Homeland Security people that would show up, and of course, now we have fusion centers and everything else. It's a different atmosphere now. You know, and
I'm speaking of 1987.
Yeah,
for sure.
So but when you go back to 87, yeah, I got a hard time swallowing the CIA shutting down local PD when local PD couldn't seem to shut down local PD in 87. You know,
I mean, let's be clear. If there was one bit of evidence, I would latch onto it. I would chase that down. There's not, you know, it's like you just can't make stuff up. You just can't decide since this feels like a CIA plot, then it must be. You just can't do that. You have to be ruthless with yourself if you're looking for the truth. I mean,
right.
If you're looking for scary stories to tell yourself about evil CIA, whatever, then, you know, by all means, go nuts. But
oh yeah, and listen, if somebody has that kind of evidence, I mean, send it my way or send it to Flatley's way, and we'll look at it. I mean,
let's get to the bottom of it.
Get to the bottom of it because
The reason I get into these stories is because I think that there's some kernel of truth, and I want to figure it out. Like, the only reason I looked into the Finder story is because Nick Bryant wrote, you know, The Franklin Scandal, which in some ways is a very credible book, and I read it, and the first chapter is about the Finders, and I was like, well, if what he's saying is true, this is serious. And I spent 2 weeks, like, making phone calls and, you know, initiating some public records requests and tracking down people who knew the finders and, you know, journalists, and just 2 weeks of my life. And I became convinced that this story was BS. And I thought, why? How come I was able to figure this out in 2 weeks if, like, Nick Bryant, who, you know, is very a masterful investigative journalist, wasn't able to do that? Like, why are people taking this story at face value, which is essentially what's going on?
I understand. The Franklin cover-up, though, I do take very seriously. And, I mean, there's just a lot of evidence that goes along with this that
Yeah, and that's kind of like my critique of conspiracy culture is, you know, for years, conspiracy theorists are the only people that would talk about Franklin, right? So, you know, that's on the mainstream media, and that's on law enforcement for not doing anything about this. So now the independent research community has to. And then the independent research community gets it and does not have the rigor, you know, the investigative rigor that they should have. And a book like the Franklin Scandal comes out, which is like, you know, some percentage very real, very shocking, some percentage kind of BS. And now the situation is completely muddled, and as far as I'm concerned, there's never going to be justice for anybody who was hurt, whoever that was. You know, so it's like, you know, I just believe that if we're in a subculture that prides itself on, you know, uncovering the truth that no one else will, you know, dare say, that we have to have some rigor, and we have to police our own. We got to call people out when they're, you know, people hate doing that. People hate calling out. Who was it? I can't remember. Colin Ross. Colin Ross, the former ISSTD president. He's a complete lunatic. He wrote The CIA Doctors, which is a terrible book, has no credibility. Right. And you talk to people in the conspiracy or alternative news community who know him, and you get him off the record, and they'll talk about how he's nuts or he's just plain wrong. But then you get on a podcast, people are like, well, you know, some of his stuff is pretty good. It's like, no, we got to call these people out.
Right, right. Well, anyway, enough of the hammering on this, because like I said, it's back to this Norman Mailer thing, though. He encounters him at this youth hostel, which is being run by the leader of the Finders at the time. Yeah.
The future Finders. So Marion Petty.
Finders don't exist yet, and Mailer shows up. Okay, now I got it.
It's like 10 years before the Finders exist, and Marion Petty's trying to figure out, how do I get my communal movement on the ground? And one of the first things he did was start a youth hostel. And, you know, some beatniks from Washington, D.C. came down and were staying in the youth hostel and writing their books or their poetry or whatever, and wearing berets, probably. And one day they were excited. They're like, Norman's coming. So Norman Mailer visits, and Marion Petty and his two sons, who are like teenagers at the time, go down to meet Norman Mailer. And, you know, Mailer and his friends and all their girlfriends are proceeding to get drunk. Mailer starts... you know, they end up, like, you know, they're drunk, they're roughhousing, they end up wrestling, and at some point, a knife appears. Nobody's sure exactly what happens, but the guy who got stabbed was like, oh, Mailer stabbed me, and you know, and he just got into trouble for stabbing somebody, so he split, he disappeared, and I think it turned out later that this guy, like, I think everybody was aware that Mailer didn't stab him, that it was an accident, that he had the knife. But, you know, talk about street cred, being the beatnik who was stabbed by Norman Mailer. I think, you know, it'd be pretty cool. So I, you know, I covered that story just because it's, I mean, it more or less is just an unknown piece of literary history involving the Finders, but
yeah. You
know, there's something, you know, there's something I'm trying to parse out about, like, violence in American life. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, there's kind of an imperfect analogy there. Mailer was, you know, obsessed with violence and interested in violence and trying to figure out what these extremes of... He was an existentialist, like an American existentialist who was trying to understand the extremes of human experience. Right. And it led him into a dark, messed up place where he almost killed his wife. And then, like, the things that the Finders are blamed, you know, are accused of doing are extremely upsetting and violent. They didn't do them, but, like, you know, these ideas, this Operation Monarch, violence on children, mind control, things exist. If they don't exist in reality, they exist kind of in dark fantasies of people who are afraid of it, you know? So it's kind of like, I don't know, like I said, the analogy's imperfect. I'm not entirely sure where I was going with that, but there just seems to be something about violence in the American psyche that we haven't even begun to reckon with. And that's kind of what I wanted to explore in that story.
Right.
It was written, you know, as I was writing it, that shooting in Buffalo happened, which, you know,
right,
it's like 45 minutes from where I grew up. So I think that was on my mind too.
Yeah. Well, and there we go again. We have, the American propensity for violence. And I guess there's a metaphoric kind of thing here. With the situation with Mailer that one could draw out of it, but I mean, it's a bit of a trip around the lake, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think it's one of those things that needs to be tackled properly. Like, why is it so ingrained, it seems like, in this, you know, very short time that this place has existed that we live in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, how many years have we actually not actively been engaged in military operations, in war?
Right.
You know, how many years of peace and tranquility have been part of the American experience, really?
I think in our lifetime, there was like a 2-year period or something while Jimmy Carter was president that, like, we weren't overtly involved in overseas wars. I mean, that
briefly,
doesn't mean
yeah.
that our guys weren't out there, you know, but it's like, you know, there was no Vietnam. There was no Grenada.
Right.
You know, so it's like, I mean, so that, yeah, I mean, it's our business. War is our business, you know?
Well, and it is a racket after all.
Yeah, it sure is.
You know, so I don't know, man. It's just, it's one of those things that is never properly confronted, I would say, by, and you see it every now and then where people want to talk about it, but they break it down to, well, it's about the guns. And
yeah.
No, it's actually about, you know, economic disparity. But even the people that claim to analyze that properly do not. You know, they're always speaking from some ivory tower, and they try to claim that they're not. And I always shake my head at it, where it's like, how do you understand this experience?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you went to college, you did this, you did that, you got this publishing contract, you're, you know, making your TV appearances. At which point, you know, I mean, and I know that there is plenty of well-ignored literature from people who are steeped in, you know, the streets one way or another. It never quite gets the attention, although if somebody analyzed what was being said there, if somebody analyzed the circumstance, like, I find it extremely ironic that... you know, and this isn't about violence necessarily, but one of the things that contributed to a very violent time in our lifetimes, when, you know, Ricky Ross, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was a prolifically intelligent businessman, really, who figured out, you know, how to work with the cocaine traffic, as it was, and did this quite well, right? Now, today, you know, he's completely... engaged in a legitimate weed business.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean,
yeah.
We definitely have a changing culture here. Okay. You know, look, if it's perfectly legal where he is, then that means that, you know, it's all good, but still the federal government has its, you know, issues with cannabis. And so on. But we're in a transitional time where it just seems to me like people are looking for, you know, it, like the level of violence is never quite enough for some people.
Yeah.
It just, you know, we need more conflict. We need more confrontation. Even if it's, you know, over very ignorant points of view, or if it's over some, well, programmed points of view that are given to us as the most divisive issues, one way or another.
Right.
You know, whereas the nuance is never discussed, whereas the real condition, it's like, well, economic disparity contributes to, yeah, no kidding it does, but it's not the only factor. You know, like the psychology that I always get into with, you know, when people say, well, you know, you look at this and there's all this crime in these particular areas and this and that. It's like, well, if you get down to the mentality and you actually interact with people that are engaged in that, you start to learn that it boils down to a very basic thing, which is that if there is no sanctity to human life, okay,
yeah,
not just everybody else's human life, but your own, and then it causes your behavior patterns to shift. It causes your ethos to be askew from the idea that other people have a right to exist because you don't feel as though you have a right to exist. Now, I know that's very touchy-feely and liberal and blah, 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 but that's the truth,
yeah,
of it. You know, why does a 14-year-old, you know, wind up spraying bullets around and shoot a 6-year-old? Because they don't feel like they're worth anything, neither is anybody else.
Sure. I mean, you know, you talk about, you know, if you start talking about 14-year-olds, you know, there's like developmentally, there's cognitive things going on. But it's like we have people who go through their whole life, and then you're absolutely right, become adults, and either they have no sense of like what it, their fellow human's humanity or their humanity, or humans are very good, Americans are very good at like, you know, siloing people off. So it's like, I can be a great guy with my family, with my kids, but then I consider the guy across the street to not even be human for whatever stupid reason. And it's like, I think, you know, I blame capitalism myself, but it's like, but you know, that's yeah, just some, you know, that's just the top of like a descending, you know, of a descending, like the root cause is somewhere in the middle. By the time you get to the outer layer of the onion, you have capitalism or whatever,
yeah,
you know, but
yeah,
there's something very human about being a piece of garbage.
Well, but that's the thing, is that, you know, and if you're steeped for a time in that culture,
mm-hmm,
where, look, the only value you have is what it is you can scrape up, and yeah, that's all there is, day to day,
mm-hmm,
it's going to change the way that you handle other people, and therefore create different resonant effects. So Why do I keep going back to this point? Because I'm kind of, again, you live in the parts of America that nobody wants to look at. You live, yeah, in the invisible America for a little while where you don't count.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Where, oh, that's awful. Somebody should do something about that. Nobody even says that, you understand, when you're in certain parts of this country, yeah, which could coexist in the very same space where people think, well, that's just a city, that's just a town, that's just, you know, oh, poor people, they're just dumb, so they, mm-hmm, do stuff. And it's like, that's not it. Poor people are not always stupid. As a matter of fact, you know, some of you middle class and upper class people would never survive a week in the circumstances where a certain level of intelligence has to be exercised on a daily basis in order to make it through the day, you know. And again, it's not necessarily just about money, but if there's no opportunity, if there's no nutrition, if your water's bad, if everything is allowed to be in disrepair because, screw them, it's just them, if it's okay for, you know, heroin to devastate your community, but once, you know, the pills got out among the rest of the communities, oops, it's a crisis now.
Yeah.
You know, there's a certain gradient experience here.
Mm-hmm. That, there's a certain point where poverty is violence, like where poverty.
Yeah.
You know, if the system is going to allow poverty to exist, it's just as bad as if they're going around shooting people. And we live in a country that's kind of like become hypnotized to this idea that like there's something natural or normal about poverty and that we should like deal with it, but you know, not before we send $54 billion to the Ukraine.
Well, and the other weird concept is, you know, the only reason why people are like that is because they're lazy, and that's, you know, they don't want any better, so therefore they don't get any better, which is a weird thing, which is why I always like looking at what J.P. Satilli talks about on occasion. I haven't had him on the show in quite a while, but I really wish he would come back, because I see how right he was about so many things I talked to him about over the years. But one of the key things that he talks about, which is ingrained in American culture, which I think people don't recognize how toxic it is the Calvinist concept.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, very much like, look, here's a rich guy. You know why he's rich? Because he's smarter than us. You know why? He's better. You know, and it goes back to that Calvinist concept that, you know, pretty much the Lord blesses those that, you know, are blessed. And that's why they prosper.
Oh, it's so ingrained, this whole idea that, like, work harder. Like, I had this conversation with a good friend of mine who should know better, who, you know, I was like, you know, I'm trying to make some money. I'm, you know, I'm doing this freelance thing. Do you have any tips for me as far as, like, resources to find gigs or whatever? And he's like, you just have to work harder. You just can't stop working. You just, you know. And then he started, like, listing all his gigs. And it's like, I'm willing to work harder. But there's got to be work, you know.
Right.
It's just like, we're so inclined to think that people that aren't doing well, that they're doing something wrong, or that there's intrinsically something wrong with them. And it's just... And it's just such a pernicious belief, and it's just so ingrained.
Because that's the thing, that's the opposite of the idea that, you know, the rich guy is rich because that's the way it's supposed to be. They, mm-hmm. You also got to remember, why are these people broke and have nothing? Well, that's the way it's supposed to be. You know what I'm saying? Like, in other words, they are obviously not blessed, which is this other thing that permeates even evangelical culture. Where, you know what, if you're not with us, well, you're of the devil. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So it's like the opposite, the inverse of the idea is actually the more destructive part of it. Well, you know, they're cursed is why they're poor, pretty much, mm-hmm. You know, and that's the way it is. And this leads to a whole lot of, again, grouping people together and trying to say that they are collectively... You know, again, either blessed or the opposite of blessed. I don't know. The thing is, it's like, yeah, that's just what that is.
Uh-huh.
It's almost like this very loose sort of American caste idea. And yeah. I know it's not just about economics, though. It's about the entire experience. Because even when somebody is a victim of something, right? Which, again, I brought this up earlier this week about how the shooting in California, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not as big a deal when it's Asian-on-Asian crime. They couldn't even sell that to TV viewers as, look, it's bleeding, it's leading, and it's gotten exciting almost, you know, listen, I don't mean to sound offensive to anybody about it, but here's the deal. It's almost television scripted. Okay, and I'm not saying that somebody scripted it. What I'm saying is, if you saw this as a scene in a TV show, you'd probably be engaged in it. Because a guy goes forward, sacrifices himself to tackle a gunman, and mm-hmm. then a man of the cloth, one way or another, pastor, preacher, I think he's a pastor, bashes the guy with a chair. And then the parishioners hogtie him. Right? Now, if this was a scenario in an action-packed TV show you were watching...
Yeah, if this was Kiefer Sutherland or something.
Yeah, if it was, people would say, well, that was pretty well done. That was well thought out. That's exciting and engaging. So, as a product, as something that the media could push, it seems like, well, this makes perfect sense. But you know what? It's Asian on Asian crime. It doesn't have that element of hate. It doesn't have that element of conflict because, well, let's... Listen, I'll speak bluntly, and Joe, if you're mad at me, I what can I say? I think it it just doesn't matter because it's just, it's just them on them.
Yeah, I mean, no, you're absolutely right. In America, this is not a good thing. I don't like it. But the default is white, and it's like when something happens with white people, it's shocking. And then it's like when something happens to the other... and it's competing with Johnny Depp, mm-hmm. and it's competing with this guy in Buffalo, it's going to get lost in the noise, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's just completely insane, like, that's how we think. But it's just so ingrained, and it's, like, so... And I don't blame me or you or, like, the listeners, but I blame the... and I don't necessarily think us as individuals think that way, but the people at the top of the news agencies... you know, TV news or whatnot, they don't know enough, or they don't care enough to analyze why they do this and make the news, you know, more woke, for lack of a better term.
Well, look, because, first, you know, and foremost,
make money.
Yeah, first and foremost, it's about the ratings and the viewership, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then secondarily, it's about compliance with an overall narrative that they're falling in line with, because look, you got a plan for next season, which in the case of the 24-hour news cycle means it's only a few days mm-hmm. before the intensity of interest is dropped. I mean, even consider the 24/7 wall-to-wall coverage of Ukraine, which is still pretty continuous. They knew that their audience was starting to, you know, get a little numb. So we had to switch to something else. I mean, and propagandists within our government, now you and I could have all sorts of nuanced discussions here, but let's be real for a second and not even delve into, you know, how it is we might feel about COVID and everything else. The fact that I'm now seeing monkeypox being positioned, okay, and I brought this up like months and months ago uh-huh. about monkeypox. I said, look at that. They just splashed that out there and it went away. Monkeypox is going to be a thing. Well, yeah. You know, some months later when everybody is, you know, oh, COVID exhaustion, nobody's going to go for the lockdowns again. Nobody's going to go for the fear porn on that again. Whether you believe, no matter what you believe about it, you got to say that there was a level of fear porn that was being sold.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So, you know, whether you think it's entirely legitimate, you think it's a hoax, you think it's a pandemic, all these things, it doesn't matter. I will tell you that no matter who you are, you should agree that you were sold fear on this. A lot of it.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that fear porn is always in the bag of tricks that the media has and the government has, and it's always uncalled for. Like,
right.
If they happen to be freaking you out about something that you believe is a legitimate problem or not, it's still losing your mind like that. It's just, it's never called for, and it's always either because they want to control your movements by fear, or control your pocketbook by fear.
Well, and it's a good business model because, again, just like their sponsors at Big Pharmaceuticals and all of their subsidiary companies, because, you know, you tune to Fox News and you got catheter companies and, you know, make sure you get your erectile dysfunction pills. You go over to, what is it, MSNBC, and what do you have? 8 different drugs for if you're HIV positive, you know, that they sell you. Plus, everybody sells you heart medication because everybody's got a heart problem, you know, or vaccines or whatever, right? Plus, go get your new vaccine because we have a new vaccine for, I don't know, pneumonia or shingles or whatever. Either way, medical products, all those companies, you know, a lot of them not looking to repair or heal anybody, but create a reliable customer base, which addiction to things like fear, like anxiety, okay, which is more accurately what it, I mean, it's fear porn. Yeah, that's an easy and really good way to put it. But it's actually, in truth, it's anxiety dope. It's anxiety doping of the system, where anxiety is useful if I can keep you anxious and worried. I mean, how many people are going to stay tuned to the Weather Channel when they know tornadoes are coming?
Uh-huh.
Right?
Oh, we're a species, a race, and a nation addicted to adrenaline. We're all adrenaline junkies.
That's it. And one of the best ways and easiest ways to do is to get you worried, concerned, afraid of some boogeyman, invisible enemies especially, whether they be a virus or they be a concept or an ism of one type or another, be very afraid. Anyway, I wouldn't advise you to do that if you go over to failedstateupdate.com, because author Joseph L. Flatley was with me here for this meandering hour about the violence in America, fear porn, the finders, all kinds of stuff we covered here, but this is the way it goes, and this is also what happens when J.G. Michael doesn't show up. But anyway,
he had a real calming influence.
He does, but you know what? I enjoyed this, Joe, so I appreciate you, man. Anyway, LennyFlatley.net, you can still go over there, check out his books, check out his publications, his podcast, sign up for the newsletter, all that stuff. The So-Called Prophet from Pittsburgh, I still highly recommend that. The Ocelli Effect is done for tonight, so no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, remember, I am merely Ocelli, and all of you are indeed the effect. Good night.